The morning after the banquet and my hour of freedom, we woke to find that during the night the river had swollen with the commencement of the annual flood. We had no warning of it until the joyous cries of the watchman down at the port aroused us. Still heavy with wine, I left my bed and ran down to the riverside. Both banks were already lined with the populace of the city. They greeted the waters with prayers and songs and waving palm fronds. The low waters had been the bright green of the verdigris that grows on bars of copper. The waters of the inundation had flushed it all away, and now the river had swollen to an ominous grey. During the night it had crept halfway up the stone pylons of the harbour, and soon it would press against the earthworks of the embankment. Then it would force its way into the mouths of the irrigation canals that had been cracked and dry for so many months. From there it would swirl out and flood the fields, drowning the huts of the peasants and washing away the boundary markers between the fields. The surveying and replacement of the boundaries after each flood was the responsibility of the guardian of the waters. Lord Intef had multiplied his fortune by favouring the claims of the rich and the generous when the time came round each year to reset the marker stones. From upstream echoed the distant rumble of the cataract. The rising flood overwhelmed the natural barrages of granite that were placed in its path, and as it roared through the gorges, the spray rose into the hard blue sky, a silver column that could be seen from every quarter of the Nome of Aswan. When the fine mist drifted across the island, it was cool and refreshing on our upturned faces. We delighted in this blessing, for it was the only rain we ever knew in our valley. Even as we watched, the beaches around our island were eaten up by the flood. Soon our jetty would be submerged, and the river would lap at the gates of our garden. Where it would stop was a question that could only be calculated by a study of the levels of the Nilometer. On those levels hung prosperity or famine for the whole land, and every person in it. I hurried back to find my mistress and to prepare for the ceremony of the waters, in which I would play a prominent role. We dressed in our finest and placed my new gold chain around my neck. Then, with the rest of our household and the ladies of the harem, we joined the spontaneous procession to the temple of Hapi. Pharaoh and all the great lords of Egypt led us. The priests, plump with rich living, were waiting for us on the temple steps. Their heads were shaven, their pates shining with oil, and their eyes glittering with avarice, for the king would sacrifice lavishly today. Before the king, the statue of the god was carried from the sanctuary and decked with flowers and fine crimson linen. Then the statue was drenched in oils and perfume while we sang psalms of praise and thanks to the god for sending down the flood. Far to the south, in a land that no civilized man had ever visited, the god Hapi sat on top of his mountain, and from two pitchers of infinite capacity he poured the holy waters into his Nile. The water from each pitcher was of a different colour and taste. One was bright green and sweet, the other grey and heavy with the silt which flooded our fields each season and charged them with new life and fertility. While we sang, the king made sacrifice of corn and meats and wine and silver and gold. Then he called out his wise men, his engineers and his mathematicians, and bade them enter the Nilometer to begin their observations and their calculations. In the time that I had belonged to Lord Intef, I had been nominated as one of the keepers of the water. I was the only slave in that illustrious company, but I consoled myself by the fact that very few others wore the gold of praise, and that they treated me with respect. They had worked with me before, and they knew my worth. I had helped to design the Nilometers that measured the flow of the river, and I had supervised the building of them. It was I who had worked out the complex formula to determine the projected height and the volume of each flood from the observations. Our way, lit by flickering torches of pitch-dipped rushes, I followed the high priest into the mouth of the Nilometer, a dark opening in the rear wall of the sanctuary. We descended the incline shaft, the stone steps slippery with slime and the effusions of the river. From under our feet, one of the deadly black water cobras slithered away, and with a furious hiss plunged into the dark water that had already risen halfway up the shaft. We gathered on the last exposed step, and by the light of the torches studied the marks that my masons had chiselled in the walls of the shaft. Each of the symbols had values, both magical and empirical, allotted to it. We made the first and most crucial reading together with extreme care. Over the following 5 days, we would take it in turns to watch and record the rising waters, and time the readings with the flow of a water clock. From samples of the water, we would estimate the amount of silt it bore, and all these factors would influence our final conclusions. When the 5 days of observation were completed, we embarked on a further 3 days of calculations. These covered many scrolls of papyrus. Finally, we were ready to present our findings to the king. On that day, Pharaoh returned to the temple in royal state, accompanied by his nobles and half the population of Elephantine to receive the estimates. As the high priest read them aloud, the king began to smile. We had forecast an inundation of almost perfect proportions. It would not be too low to leave the fields exposed and baking in the sun, depriving them of the rich black layer of silt so vital to their fertility, nor would it be so high as to wash away the canals and earthworks, and to drown the villages and cities along the banks. This season would bring forth bountiful harvests and fat herds. Pharaoh smiled, not so much for the good fortune of his subjects, but for the bounty that his tax collectors would gather in. The annual taxes were computed on the value of the flood, and this year there would be vast new treasures added to the storerooms of his funerary temple. To close the ceremony of the blessing of the water in the temple of Hapi, Pharaoh announced the date of the biennial pilgrimage to Thebes to participate in the festival of Osiris. It did not seem possible that 2 years had passed since my mistress had played the part of the goddess in the last passion of Osiris. I had as little sleep that night as when I had kept vigil in the shaft of the Nilometer, for my mistress was too excited to seek her own couch. She made me sit up with her until dawn, singing and laughing, and repeating those stories of Tanis to which she never tired of listening. In 8 days the royal flotilla would sail northwards on the rising flood of the Nile. When we arrived, Tanis, Lord Harab, would be waiting for us in Thebes. My mistress was delirious with happiness. The flotilla that assembled in the harbour roads of Elephantine was so numerous that it seemed to cover the water from bank to bank. My mistress remarked jokingly that a man might cross the Nile without wetting his feet by strolling over the bridge of hulls. With pennants and flags flying from every masthead, the fleet made a gallant show. We and the rest of the court had already embarked on the vessels that had been allotted to us, and from the deck we cheered the king as he descended the marble steps from the palace and went aboard the great state barge. The moment he was safely embarked, 100 horns sounded the signal to set sail. As one, the fleet squared away and pointed their bows into the north. With the rush of the river and the banks of oars driving us, we bore away. There had been a different spirit abroad in the land since Achorus had destroyed the shrikes. The inhabitants of every village we passed came down to the water's edge to greet their king. Pharaoh sat high on the poop, wearing the cumbersome double crown, so that all might have a clear view of him. They waved palm fronds and shouted, "May all the gods smile on Pharaoh!" The river brought down to them not only their king, but also the promise of its own benevolence, and they were happy. Twice during the days that followed, Pharaoh and all his train went ashore to inspect the monuments that Achorus had raised to his passing at the crossroads of the caravan routes. The local peasants had preserved these gruesome piles of skulls as sacred relics of the new god. They had polished each skull until it shone like ivory, and bound the pyramids with building clay so that they would stand through the years. Then they had built shrines over them and appointed priests to serve these holy places. At both these shrines my mistress left a gold ring as an offering, joyously accepted by the self-appointed guardians. It was to no avail that I protested this extravagance. My mistress often lacked the proper respect for the wealth that I was so painstakingly amassing on her behalf. Without my restraining hand she would probably have given it all away to the grasping priesthood and the insatiable poor, smiling as she did so. On the 10th night, after leaving Elephantine, the royal entourage camped on a pleasant promontory above a bend in the river. The entertainment that evening was to include one of the most famous storytellers in the land, and usually my mistress loved a good story above most other pleasures. Both she and I had been looking forward to this occasion and discussing it avidly since leaving the palace. It was therefore to my surprise and bitter disappointment that the Lady Lostris declared herself too fatigued and out of sorts to attend the storyteller. Although she urged me to go and take the rest of our household with me, I could not leave her alone when she was unwell. I gave her a hot draught, and I slept on the floor at the end of her bed, so that I could be near if she needed me during the night. I was truly worried in the morning when I tried to wake her. Usually she would spring from her bed with a smile of anticipation, ready to seize and devour the new day, a glutton for the joy of living. However, this morning she pulled the covers back over her head and mumbled, "Leave me to sleep a little longer. I feel as heavy and dull as an old woman." "The king has decreed an early start. We must be aboard before the sun rises. I will bring you a hot infusion. That will cheer you." I poured boiling water over a bowl of herbs that I had picked with my own hands during the most propitious phase of the last moon. "Do stop fussing," she grumped at me. But I would not let her sleep again. I prodded her awake and made her drink the tonic. She pulled a face. "I swear you are trying to poison me," she complained. And then, without warning, and before I could do anything to prevent it, she vomited copiously. Afterwards she seemed as shocked as I was. We both stared at the steaming puddle beside her bed in consternation. "What is wrong with me, Taita?" she whispered. "Nothing like this has ever happened to me before." Only then did the meaning of it all dawn on me. "The Khamsin," I cried. "The cemetery of Tras! Tanus!" She stared at me blankly for a moment, and then her smile lit the gloom of the tent like a lamp. "I am making a baby," she cried. "Not so loud, mistress," I pleaded. "Tanus's baby. I am carrying Tanus's son." It could not be the king's infant, for I had successfully kept him from her bed since her starvation sickness and her miscarriage. "Oh, Taita," she purred, as she lifted her nightdress and inspected her flat, firm belly with awe. "Just think of it. A little imp, just like Tanus, growing inside of me." She palpated her stomach hopefully. I knew that such delights as I discovered in the tomb of Tras could not pass unremarked by the gods. They have given me a memory that will last all my lifetime. "You race ahead," I warned her. "It may be only a colic. I must make the tests before we can be sure." "I need no test. I know it in my heart and in the secret depths of my body." "We will do the tests," I told her wryly, and went to fetch the pot. She perched upon it to provide me with the first water of her day, and I divided this into two equal parts. The first portion of her urine I mixed with an equal part of Nile water. Then I filled two jars with black earth, and in each of them planted 5 seeds of Dara corn. I watered one jar with pure Nile water, and the other with the mixture that my mistress had provided. This was the first test. Then I hunted amongst the reeds in the lagoon near the camp and captured 10 frogs. These were not the lively green and yellow variety with leaping back legs, but slimy black creatures. Their heads are not separated from their sluggish fat bodies by a neck, and their eyes sit on top of the flat skull, so that the children call them sky-gazers. I placed 5 of each of the sky-gazers in 2 separate jars of river water. To the one I added my mistress's intimate emission, and I left the other unadulterated. The following morning, in the privacy of my mistress's cabin on board the galley, we removed the cloth with which I had covered the jars and inspected the contents. The corn watered by the Lady Lostris had thrown tiny green shoots, while the other seeds were still inert. The 5 sky-gazers who had not received my mistress's blessing were barren, but the other more fortunate 5 had each laid long silvery strings which were speckled with black eggs. "I told you so," my mistress chirped smugly, before I could give my official diagnosis. "Oh, thanks to all the gods! No more beautiful thing has happened to me in all my life." "I will speak to Aton immediately. You will share the king's couch this very night," I told her grimly, and she stared at me in bewilderment. "Even Pharaoh, who believes most things I tell him, will not believe that you were impregnated by the seeds blown in on the Khamsin wind. We must have a foster father for this little bastard of ours." Already I considered the infant ours, and not hers alone. though I tried to conceal it behind my levity. I was every bit as delighted with her fecundity as she was. "Don't you ever call him a bastard again," she flared at me. "He will be a prince." "He will be a prince only if I can find a royal sire for him. Prepare yourself. I am going to see the king."